This is an ABC podcast.
This is RN. I'm David Rutledge, and you're in the Philosopher's Zone. Today we're looking at a philosopher who you could almost call the patron saint of misfits. He was an oddball, a social outsider. He wore eccentric, old-fashioned clothes. He walked around with an exaggerated scholarly stoop. People openly laughed at him in the street, and he was a figure of fun in the local newspaper. Everybody thought he was weird, but then, in a way, this was a weird time. We're talking Denmark in the early to mid-19th century, when Europe was being transformed at a rate that people had never really experienced before. Science and technology were revolutionising the lives of ordinary people, and there was a cultural earthquake underway, with religion in particular coming up against new challenges.
He actually lived in a Christian culture in Denmark that was quite homogenous. All Danish people were just baptised into the Danish state church, and they called themselves Christians, they saw each other as Christians. So they were living this form of Christian life, which in one sense they weren't calling into question, but beneath that apparently smooth surface of a shared religious culture were these currents of change and a real unsettling of religious belief. And much of his philosophy is about addressing the question of what it means to be a Christian in his own world with all this social change and religious change going on.
He was Søren Kierkegaard, sometimes called the father of existentialism. Wittgenstein called him by far the most profound thinker of the 19th century. But brought up in a strict Lutheran form of Christianity, Kierkegaard was as much a theologian as he was a philosopher, although, as we're about to hear, he had an ambivalent relationship with his own faith tradition. The events of Kierkegaard's life and the development of his ideas are very closely intertwined. He's one of those thinkers who, when you read him, you get a strong sense of personal connection of what his life was like. And this was certainly the case for Claire Carlisle, a reader in philosophy and theology at King's College London, whose investigations into Kierkegaard led her to write a biography of him that was published just recently. It's called Philosopher of the Heart, The Restless Life of Søren Kierkegaard. Well, Claire Carlisle caught up with Hong Jiang recently to tell us about this inspiring, if somewhat tortured, character.
When I set out to write the book, my aim was to write what I saw as a philosophical biography of Kierkegaard. That's to say, I didn't just want to tell a factual story about his life, but I wanted to explore the meaning of his life as a philosophical question. And that's a very kind of broad and deep philosophical question about what it means to be a human being, what the meaning and the purpose of a human life might be, what the truth of a life might be, and so on. So I wanted the book to explore those philosophical questions in general, and also how those philosophical questions were answered by Kierkegaard himself in his own life. So that was my aim from the beginning. But then as I went about doing that, I realised that it wasn't just philosophical in a general way, but it was actually philosophical in a way that was quite true to Kierkegaard's particular philosophical ideas. So Kierkegaard is now known often as the father of existentialism. And this means that he was confronting questions about how to be a human being, the nature of our freedom and identity. He wrote about experiences of anxiety and despair. And so these are some of the philosophical ideas that I trace through Kierkegaard's own life, through his own personal experience. A really important idea in Kierkegaard's philosophy is what he calls subjectivity or inwardness. And that means the first person experience that each of us have, the inner experience that we have of ourselves and of our own lives. And he wanted to write philosophy from that point of view. So my biography tries to focus on Kierkegaard's own inwardness, on his subjective experience. And what that means is that I was interested in thinking about what his life meant to him and how he understood his life and how he felt about his life, rather than taking an approach as a kind of detached observer where I was looking at him from the outside and describing the more external or objective events and actions of his life, and trying to look at his life from the inside. And that's something that, yeah, reflects Kierkegaard's own approach to philosophy. And he thought philosophy was something that should really be related to the what he would call the existential questions that we each face, like how should we live, what kind of person should we be, the kinds of choices that we need to make. And for him, that was really the substance of philosophical inquiry, rather than more abstract or kind of universal questions that other philosophers might focus on.
Was that a common way of writing for philosophers in that time period?
No, not at all. So he really invented a new way of doing philosophy, and this is one of the reasons why he's been so influential since the 19th century. One of the philosophers that he was very critical of was Hegel, the German philosopher, and Hegel wrote in a very systematic way, and he wrote a kind of encyclopedic philosophical system that aimed to understand. It was like a theory of everything, you know, it was a theory of the whole of human history, a theory of nature, a theory of politics, as well as kind of a metaphysical sort of theory of God and the world and so on. So Hegel was a philosopher who created a kind of grand theory of everything. And Kierkegaard wanted to take the opposite view and to focus on what he called the single individual and the subjectivity or inwardness of each human being. And then he ended up writing in a very creative, literary way to try and explore that inwardness. So his writing is quite poetic, quite novelistic. Sometimes he has fictional characters through whom he explores this kind of first person subjective encounter with philosophical questions.
What do you see as the significant life events that influenced or impacted on his writing the most?
Well, I've already said something about his relationship with his religious upbringing, and that was really formative for him. As I said, he had this strict religious upbringing from his father, which Kierkegaard was very ambivalent about. He was ambivalent towards his father. I think his father was a difficult man who, on the one hand, was very loving, but also quite strict with high expectations. And Kierkegaard's kind of both love and fear of his father, connected with his father's Christianity, gave Kierkegaard an ambivalent relationship to religion itself. So that was something that was completely formative and shaped his thinking. But the decisive event of Kierkegaard's life, certainly as I interpret it in the biography, is his relationship with a woman called Regina Olsen. And Kierkegaard became engaged to Regina when he was in his late 20s, and she was several years younger than him, so she was about 19. And Kierkegaard and Regina met while he was still a university student, and they fell in love. He asked her to marry him, and then almost immediately felt that he'd made a mistake and that he couldn't marry her. It took him, you know, several months to come to the decision that he should break off the engagement. So he did, in fact, break off their engagement a year after he proposed to her. She was devastated. She begged him to reconsider. And so they had this quite drawn out situation that was very painful and difficult for both of them, this long breakup. But that wasn't only something that was kind of emotionally painful for him. It was also quite scandalous in a more public social sense, because, you know, to ask a woman to marry you and then change your mind and break it off is not a great thing to do nowadays. But in the 19th century, that really could potentially have ruined the woman's life, because if she's been engaged to somebody who's then broken it off, there was a very good chance that no one else would want to marry her and that she would remain single for her whole life. That actually didn't happen to Regina after she broke off with Kierkegaard. You know, a few years later, she did marry somebody else. But at the time, it was a really scandalous thing, and everybody was very disapproving about the way he'd mistreated this nice young woman. So that was a decisive event of his life. And it was after he broke his engagement to Regina that he wrote his first important work of philosophy, which is called Either Or. And in that book, he actually writes about romantic love, he writes about marriage, freedom, decisions, and so on. So in that first philosophical book, he really explores some of the big themes and questions that arose out of his breakup from Regina, questions about what kind of life he himself was choosing to live in deciding not to get married to her and to live a different kind of life. So that was really the beginning of his authorship. And he returned again and again in his writings to not He never wrote about Regina herself. He never mentioned her by name, but he returned to the situation of romantic love, of engagements. He has several characters in his book who themselves go through a broken engagement. And he has other characters who are married and talk about, you know, the virtues of married life. So he keeps coming back to the kinds of questions that really confronted him during his engagement to Regina. And that remained decisive for the rest of his life.
And do we know why he decided to break off his engagement with Regina?
Well, that's the big question. And I think, in a way, I think Kierkegaard himself spent a lot of time trying to answer that question. And the books that he wrote are philosophical books, and so they make a contribution to philosophical ideas and arguments. But they are also personal books in which he's trying to tell and retell the story of his relationship to Regina to try to make sense of it. But there isn't really a final answer to that question. What we can say is that having become engaged to Regina, he felt in a very deep way that this life as a married person was not the life that he was meant to live. So he had this strong sense of a vocation and the fact that marrying wasn't the life he should be leading. So it wasn't because he didn't like Regina and wanted to marry someone else. I mean, he there was never a question of that. But the life that he chose when he broke off the engagement with Regina was, in a way, quite an unconventional life. So he became this writer who wrote very provocative and challenging works. And in a sense, he positioned himself on the margins of society rather than, you know, being a husband and a respectable citizen, a father, and so on. It was really a sense of rejecting that conventional family kind of life and taking a more, perhaps a freer sort of life, but a less conventional one. I mean, one of the reasons, he gave several reasons, and it seems to change over the course of his writing, but one of the reasons he gave was that he felt that husbands and wives should be completely open with each other, that marriage demanded, yeah, complete openness. And he felt that he couldn't be completely open and kind of share himself with another human being, partly because he suffered a lot from melancholy and depression, and he felt that it would be unfair on her to kind of inflict his, you know, sufferings on her. So that was part of the reason. But I think that, you know, it was a really complicated set of reasons that perhaps Kierkegaard himself didn't fully understand and was trying to make sense of. This sense that he just shouldn't marry her and couldn't marry her, and that he'd made a mistake in proposing to her.
I was just thinking, we almost see that thread of Kierkegaard being an outsider as something that has stemmed from his childhood, perhaps, with, I guess, being the odd one out among his peers, and that carrying on to even his adult life as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I think one of the big questions that he's grappling with is how a person can be true to themselves while at the same time living in the world with other people. You know, I guess for some people, it's possible to live a life that's quite conventional and conforming to sort of social customs, while still feeling comfortable in yourself and that you're doing the right thing for you and what you want to do. But Kierkegaard never felt like that. I think he felt that to be true to himself required him to take some distance from the ordinary run of life and, yeah, a more conventional kind of life. So yes, there is a sense of him not quite fitting in. But it's really, I think as an artist, it was important to him to be able to take that position somewhat on the edge of the world or on the margins of society, so that he could make these quite challenging and provocative reflections on the way the world was. But I also think that that sense of not being able to be fully part of the world was something that he found difficult. I think in a way he preferred to be able to have a more normal life and to be married and have children, but he just felt that in some way that wasn't what his life was asking of him, and that to sort of be himself or be true to himself, he had to take this more difficult path as an outsider.
This is RN, you're in the Philosopher's Zone. This week, Hong Jiang is talking with Claire Carlisle from King's College London, who's just come out with a new biography of the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. He was a philosopher, but he was also a theologian, a poet, a social critic, widely considered to be the first existentialist. But given his rather uncompromising take on morality and the events of his emotionally turbulent life, Kierkegaard also shares with Hamlet the title of the Melancholy Dane. Well, at this point, we take a short detour into biblical narrative and the story of Abraham and Isaac, one of the strangest and most morally confounding stories in Jewish and Christian tradition. It goes like this. The great patriarch Abraham has a young son, Isaac. One day, God commands Abraham to take Isaac up a mountain and kill him as a sacrifice to the Lord. Abraham does what he's told. He takes Isaac up the mountain, he ties him up, he builds an altar, places Isaac on the altar, and he's about to cut the boy's throat when an angel calls down from heaven and says, "Actually, Abraham, it's okay, don't kill your son. This was all just a test of faith, and now that God knows what an obedient servant you are, you can go ahead and sacrifice a sheep instead." It's a morally confronting story, and one that fascinated Soren Kierkegaard.
This is a story that's very difficult for people to try to make sense of, difficult for readers of the Bible to kind of understand because it seems so shocking. I definitely see Kierkegaard as what I would call a spiritual seeker. And I think it's quite important to see it in those terms because, you know, he was somebody who was thinking within a Christian framework. But I don't think he liked the kind of religious attitude that was very dogmatic and thought it had all the answers to questions about God and the meaning of life and so on. I think he was much more interested in the question of what the human relationship to God might be and what God might be, rather than in giving clear answers to those questions. And he was very critical of institutional religion. So for him, you know, the Danish state church of his own day, he felt that this was kind of spiritually superficial and vacuous. So on the one hand, he was a great critic of Christianity, but he was also someone who thought within that framework and tried to, again, find a way to be true to the spiritual side of himself within this institutional religion that didn't always seem to kind of match that. And so he thought that Abraham was really interesting because Abraham, he reads Abraham as a figure who puts his relationship to God above all else, even in a sense above his human relationships, above his ethical duties as a father who was supposed to care for his son. And that sense that the relationship to God is the most important thing in life was something that I think Kierkegaard could really relate to in Abraham. And he also related to the fact that for Abraham, that relationship to God took him out of an ordinary social way of doing things and set him outside ethical life. It set him outside social conventions and so on. And I think he related it to his relationship with Regina, so that when Kierkegaard broke off with Regina, that was like quite a scandalous moral thing to do. Obviously, it's not quite as bad as what, you know, Abraham did in sacrificing Isaac, but they were also both things that seemed to be required from the point of view of their sort of spiritual life and their sense of their relationship to God. And what Kierkegaard didn't think that God had told him to break off the engagement, but he had this sense of vocation that his life was meant to be going in this other direction, which is sort of like a kind of divine command, even if it's not actually a sort of literal, in the literal sense that you get it in the biblical story of Abraham and Isaac. One of the things that Kierkegaard criticizes about Christianity in his day is that he thought it was too easy, that really, you know, 19th century Danish Christianity, a bit like 19th century sort of English Christianity, was just about sort of going to church and doing these quite conventional things that everybody else was doing, and sort of paying lip service in a way to the message of the New Testament, rather than a more radical idea of kind of giving up everything that you own and following Jesus, for example, which is the kind of idea that you get in the Gospels. So he saw Abraham's story as really reminding people of the difficult decisions that religion, or in general, and I guess Christianity in particular, might require of a person. So he was critical of, this idea that Christianity was something very easy, that everyone could do. And he wanted to show that it was actually, if you were truly sort of faithful to your relationship to God, that might actually be a very difficult thing, even perhaps an impossible thing, you know, even something that no one can really attain. So when he wrote about Abraham, he described Abraham as, in a way, a kind of impossible figure, that he says he doesn't know how he could have done what Abraham did, to highlight that this is something that's quite remarkable rather than something that's just ordinary.
On that note of Kierkegaard being very critical of organized religion in his day, in his final years, he actually attacked the Church of Denmark. What did those attacks look like?
mean, he was critical of the church really throughout his authorship, but in his earlier works, he did this in a much more indirect way, whereas in his later life, he wrote these very direct polemical attacks on the church. Some of them were in a Copenhagen newspaper, for example, and he just talked about the hypocrisy of the clergy, the fact that they were living these very comfortable, very affluent lives that were completely different from the example of Jesus, who obviously was somebody who led a very countercultural life. You know, Jesus was somebody who questioned the values and the religious customs of his day, of the sort of Jewish religion, and was doing something very different and very radical, and of course ended up, for that reason, being persecuted and being crucified. So he compares the example of Jesus, which was scandalous and very difficult and full of all this suffering and hardship and very difficult decisions, he compares that with the kind of Danish clergy who were sort of comfortably, happily married and like living these kind of easy lives. And he talked about the fact that there was basically what the kinds of lives they were living were just nothing to do with the message of Jesus. So it's quite a harsh critique. Many people who read it really disagreed with Kirchhoff and thought he was being far too provocative, far too and unfair on the church. But actually, many other readers were really inspired by Kirchhoff's critique, and particularly some younger readers and students who had that more kind of radical attitude. And so his attack on the church was, yeah, it was controversial, and it divided people in Copenhagen, and it was something that everybody was talking about.
He's actually had a major influence in Christian theology. But unlike many Christian theologians, he's also very well known and respected in philosophy as well. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because he has this existential and personal approach. So he's, as you say, he is important for theology, but he's not really interested in religious doctrine. So he doesn't spend much time arguing about the existence of God or the nature of God and, you know, those kinds of questions that theologians often focus on. Rather, he's interested in human beings and in the human condition and the human perspective on these kinds of questions. And so some of the themes that come out of that investigation of what it means to be human are things like freedom, anxiety, moral responsibility, choice, time, subjectivity, and these concepts have been taken up by philosophers, many of whom aren't at all religious and in fact are quite atheistic. So philosophers like Martin Heidegger in Germany or Jean-Paul Sartre in France, and these 20th century existentialist philosophers have taken up these ideas from Kirchhoff about the human condition and the human situation and, yeah, kind of taken them into an analysis of what it is to be a human being in a godless world. So yeah, so because he focuses on human beings, his philosophy has this universal relevance because we're all human beings. And whereas if you have a Christian theologian who's just writing about God, if people don't share those views, then that just doesn't seem relevant at all. You know, it just seems that they're writing about something that doesn't exist. Whereas if you write about human beings, we can all immediately relate to that. So that gives Kirchhoff's philosophy this relevance. And he's also very psychologically insightful. So that's another aspect of his thought that I think a lot of people can relate to and connect to. And he was someone who I think was very self-aware, and he was very interested in other people as well. You know, he was a very sociable person, and he was just fascinated by people and what they were like and by human psychology. So lots of those insights get woven into his philosophical analysis of the human condition. And yeah, that's relevant to, you know, religious and non-religious readers.
And how do you think he would have responded to his legacy as the father of existentialism?
I think he probably would have secretly felt quite pleased that he was being read and taken seriously. But he probably also would have, you know, complained about the fact that, you know, his work was being read by students on academic courses and being taught in this very theoretical way. So Kirchhoff was somebody who was quite critical of academia and the kind of abstract intellectual approach to human existence. One of the reasons why I called the book Philosopher of the Heart is partly because of these themes of inwardness and subjectivity that I've mentioned, but also because I think for Kirchhoff, he's really interested in the more emotional aspects of human experience. So love, suffering, passion, grief, these kinds of things that are really affairs of the heart were for him central to philosophy and central to our task of trying to understand who we are and what it means to be human. And so existentialism sounds like quite a theoretical thing in a way. You know, it's a sort of intellectual movement, and it's something that's studied on university courses, and there are textbooks about it. So yeah, I think Kierkegaard would have been happy to know that people were still reading him, and he's been translated into loads of different languages, and he's had this enormous influence on philosophy. But he probably would have been sort of questioning that as well, I think.
What drew you to his writing?
Well, I came to it when I was a student at university. You know, I read lots of different books by different philosophers when I was a student. And I suppose, like many of these things, you don't necessarily know why you're drawn to one thing rather than another. And when I chose to do my PhD on Kierkegaard, it was partly because one of the teachers I had at my university, George Patterson, was one of my favourite teachers. I really liked him, and he seemed to be interested in all the things that I found interesting. And he was a Kierkegaard expert. So it was really, I think, through his influence that Kierkegaard became a figure that seemed interesting and seemed worthy of further study. He's not necessarily my favourite philosopher. I think perhaps Spinoza is my favourite one. But I think often in life we just kind of are drawn in directions that we don't necessarily fully understand, and we don't sort of plan things out that way. And I think it's important to have a kind of faith and trust in that the instincts that we have and the things that draw us in certain directions should be followed. So yeah, I never expected to... I ended up writing a PhD on Kierkegaard. I never expected to become an academic or to write more books on Kierkegaard, but that's just something that's happened. And I guess for me, reading Kierkegaard, even though I don't agree with everything he says and I don't necessarily share all his religious views, but reading him gives me an opportunity to explore these questions that do really matter to me about being human and about spirituality and so on. So for me, he's kind of a complete philosopher who really explores a very full range of important elements of the experience of being human, and reading him and writing about him allows me to explore all those things as well.
Claire Carlisle, reader in philosophy and theology at King's College London, and the author of Philosopher of the Heart, The Restless Life of Søren Kierkegaard. Publication details on the website, where you can also stream or download the audio of this and all of our other programs, abc.net.au/rn. You'll find the Philosopher's Zone on the program menu or via the ABC Listen app. Claire Carlisle was speaking with Hong Jiang. I'm David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me next week when we're going to be asking, who needs the humanities? In an age of ruthless economic rationalism and chronic underemployment, isn't this whole philosophical education thing an increasingly unaffordable luxury? Join me next time, and thanks for your company this week. Bye for now.